in our ongoing lectures through this section of church history, and really in this series of lectures, we're considering church history up until the Reformation, so from the beginnings of the church till maybe about the year 1500. We've divided church history broadly into three categories. And again, I want to stress, just like I always have, that I know I'm being a bit repetitive here, but hopefully it helps us get it cemented in our mind. These divisions are not absolute. They're rough. Too much can be made of them. But just in a general sense, to sort of organize eras to help us get a little better understanding, I have divided church history into these three segments. The Apostolic Church, 33 to 100 A.D., then the early church, 100 to 312, and then this extended period of what I call the Christian Empire, 312, which I've divided into an earlier period and a later period. And this later period that we're looking at covers approximately the year 1000 to 1500. In today's lecture, we're going to take a look at an important event, or important trend would be a much better way to state it, through this general period, and that was the struggle between the spiritual and the secular powers, or maybe just a better way to state it is the struggle between the popes and the kings. So, of course, we're talking about Western Christianity here, Christianity in generally Western Europe. We're not dealing with the East. We've done with that with some previous lectures. But here we want to just focus on the concept of the partnership between kings and popes in a Christian society. Through the early part of the Middle Ages, there was a growing partnership between the powers of the church, of course represented by the pope, and the power of kings. The leadership role of Gregory the First, known as Gregory the Great, was just the beginning. Because the church was the most significant institution of society in Western Europe after the fall of the Roman Empire, it had a very natural leadership role. And so when Charlemagne was crowned emperor of the Holy Roman Empire by Pope Leo II on Christmas Day in the year 800, it was more than just recognizing that he was the leading monarch of Europe. It was much more than that. It was more than recognizing that he was the best hope for advancement in European society since the fall of the Roman Empire. It was also an expression of the delicate and often contentious relationship between the popes and the kings. You see, as things developed, there was a constant tension between the emperor and the pope. I mean, who was really in charge? The popes claimed authority over the emperors. They claimed this authority because they crowned them. After all, in the scene we saw of Charlemagne's crowning, it was Pope Leo II that set the crown upon his head, the crown of being emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. The emperors or kings usually felt more powerful than the popes did. And so it was a constant struggle, sometimes known as the investiture struggle. Now, the kings or emperors or czars, if you want to talk about the East, Russia, they won this battle in the East. In Islam, both religious and political offices would be combined in the Sultanate. But in the West, popes and kings always looked for an advantage over the other. Now, because of this dynamic, and I'm not going to say this is the only reason, but it's one of the great contributing reasons, there was always a political nature to the office of the pope. The papacy was political, far beyond what we would know or understand or be familiar with in our modern age. It was because there was this ongoing political struggle between the church and the civil government. So it doesn't surprise us that the office of pope became a highly political office. and therefore it was often filled by quite corrupt men. One of these, for example, was Pope John the 12th. He reigned from the year 955 to 963. He was charged by a council of bishops of almost every imaginable kind of crime. It was even said that he toasted the health of the devil and that he invoked the help of the pagan gods to help him in his gambling. The whole council agreed that he was a very corrupt man, but this was the reply of Pope John the 12th. He just simply replied, "If you want to set up another pope, by Almighty God, I excommunicate you so that you won't have the power to perform Mass or ordain anyone." Now, again, we read stories like this, and I understand that stories of papal corruption are oftentimes held in historical controversy. You know, what were these political acts by the Pope or political acts by the Pope's enemies? In some sense, it doesn't matter. Now, of course, it matters for the reputation of any individual Pope, but it just shows the highly political nature of the office because of the political power that the church and the head of the church in Western Europe, the Pope of the Roman Catholic Church, held. Pope Boniface VII, it was said that he came to office by strangling his predecessor in the year 974. He was described by a council of bishops as being a papal monster who in his total depravity exceeded all mortals. Now again, were these accurate descriptions? Were they exaggerations? In some sense, you can leave that aside. That's more having to do with the individuals. There's no doubt that the office itself and the church as an institution became radically political in this era. So in this general era, we have a very interesting controversy between Gregory the VII and King Henry the IV. Gregory the VII reigned as pope from the year 1073 to the year 1085. He was also known as Hildebrand. He was one of the three popes of this era who really showed the struggle between the popes and the kings. Hildebrand issued a very famous document titled Plenitudo Potestatis. In Latin, that just means the fullness of power, and it declares the Pope to be the vicar that is the representative of Christ and not Peter. Now, this was a radical change, and when a Pope declares such things, it's usually not the result of an immediate change, but something that has been going on for decades or sometimes centuries. But earlier in the history of the Roman Catholic Church, the Pope understood himself to be the vicar of Peter. Vicar is a Latin word. We get our English word vicarious, such as a vicarious atonement from that word. It means to stand in the place of or to be a representative of. So it was said that the Pope was the vicar or the representative of Peter. If Peter was on this earth, he would be the Pope. But since Peter isn't on this earth, the Pope stands in his place. He is Peter's representative. But Hildebrand, or Pope Gregory the VII, whichever title you want to give to him, he took the title Vicar of Christ. Now you have to say that is an audacious further step in the claiming of papal power. If I claim myself to be the representative of Jesus Christ on this earth, surely that's a higher step than claiming myself to be the representative of the Apostle Peter on this earth. So that was the mentality that Gregory had. I represent Jesus Christ on this earth. Now, Pope Gregory's authority was severely tested in his battle or controversy with Henry the IV. The argument was based on the important issue of appointments to church offices. The emperor and the pope both claimed the right to appoint men men whom they would choose to these politically and financially important offices. Gregory VII, the Pope, said that the emperor had no right to appoint anyone to a church office. Now, Henry IV ignored the Pope's decrees, and Gregory summoned the emperor, again, Henry IV, to Rome. Henry refused to come to the Pope, but he declared Pope Gregory to be deposed. The emperor said to Pope Gregory IV, "You're fired," or Gregory VII, actually. And Gregory responded by excommunicating King Henry, or Emperor Henry IV, and declaring him to be deposed. So here you have this great mess of a king declaring the Pope to be invalid and the Pope declaring the king to be invalid. So here is some of their correspondence. It's a letter from Gregory VII to Henry IV in December of the year 1075. "Bishop Gregory, servant of the servants of God, to King Henry, greeting and apostolic benediction, that is, if he be obedient to the apostolic chair, as is fitting for a Christian king. Since you do confess yourself to be a son of the church, it would have been fitting for your royal dignity to look more respectfully upon the master of the church, that is, Saint Peter, the chief of the apostles." So you can see here in Gregory VII's initial letter here to Henry IV, he's being very strong in him calling him to submit to the authority of the church. Well, just to give you an idea of how the kings and popes of this era would battle back, let's look now at the response that King Henry IV made to Gregory VII. This was his reply, again, in January of 1076. "Henry, king, not through usurpation, but through the holy ordination of God to Hildebrand, at present not pope, but false monk. Such greetings as this you have deserved through your disturbances, inasmuch there is no area of the church which you have failed to make yourself a partaker, not of honor, but confusion, not of blessing, but of curses." You have to admit it's a very fiery beginning here of King Henry's reply to Gregory VII. But let's continue on in that letter. He says, "Thou, therefore, damned by this curse, and by the judgment of all our bishops and by our own, descend and relinquish the apostolic chair which you have usurped. Let another ascend the throne of Saint Peter, who shall not practice violence under the cover of religion, but shall teach the sound doctrine of Saint Peter. I, Henry, King, by the grace of God, do say unto thee, together with all our bishops, descend, descend, to be damned throughout the ages." Well, they certainly knew how to speak very straightforwardly to each other in that age, did they not? So here is just to give you a little bit of the flavor of the kind of battle that would go back between the popes and the kings in this era. Now, in light of this tremendous, bitter controversy, Pope Gregory VII forced, and I would put that in little quotation marks, forced Henry IV to humbly submit in light of his disobedience to the papal power. You see, the great power that the popes had over the kings was this. The popes could say to all the Christians who lived in the realm of the kings or the emperors, "You don't have to obey him anymore. The church, the Pope says, you do not have to obey him. You do not have to pay your taxes. He's not a legitimate king." That was the power, so to speak, that the Pope had over the kings. What power did the kings have over the popes? Well, we'll see shortly. But with the power that Pope Gregory had in his threats, in his threatened excommunications of Henry IV, he forced Henry to submit in light of his disobedience to the papal power. And Henry IV did, in fact, submit. Traveling with his wife and child, Henry set out and crossed the Alps in the middle of the winter to come to the Pope's residence and humble himself at the Pope's feet. But Gregory would not receive Henry, and he made him wait outside in the snow of the courtyard of the castle. There's wood engravings of Henry with his wife and child humbly waiting outside the door. "Pope, won't you let us in?" For 3 days, he waited outside, begging the Pope to let him come and beg for forgiveness. On the fourth day, Gregory relented. He kind of knew he had to. And he let him in and restored him, repealing the excommunication that he had put upon Henry IV. And so, Henry IV made an offer of obedience to the Pope. Again, this is the year 1076. This is what he says. "Being admonished to do so by the counsel of the faithful ones, I promise to observe in all things the obedience due to the Apostolic See and to thee, Pope Gregory, and will take care devoutly to correct and to render satisfaction for anything whereby a derogation to the honor of that see or to your honor has arisen through us." Now, you read that and you say, well, it's pretty plain, isn't it? Gregory won. Henry IV lost. But that's not really how it worked out. In some sense, it was really for show on both sides. 7 years later, Henry's armies marched into Rome and drove Pope Gregory VII into exile. You see, that was the power that the kings had. They commanded armies. Now, of course, the popes, having so much political power and wealth at their disposal, sometimes they could hire armies, and they often did. But that didn't compare to the military power that was at the disposal of the kings. The popes had the power of excommunication. The kings had the power of the sword. And overall, in this general period, the kings made increasing inroads in their authority over the popes. In general, over this period, the power of the popes declined and the power of the kings increased. But despite being humbled by the kings, the popes still claimed great power. And they tried to express that power through papal decrees. The spiritual and political power that they claimed for themselves was staggering. Now, they could not always exercise the power that they claimed, but they laid great claim to great powers. Here's an example from a decree from Gregory VII that he made in March of the year 1080. Ready for these? We're going to talk through many of these here. First of all, he said that the Roman Church was founded by God alone, that the Roman pontiff or pope alone can rightly be called universal, that he alone can depose or reinstate bishops, that among other things, we not to remain in the same house as with those excommunicated by the pope, that the Pope alone may use the imperial insignia, that the Pope alone shall all the princes kiss the feet, that in his name alone shall be spoken in the churches, that this is the only name in the world, that he may be permitted to depose emperors, that no chapter and no book shall be considered canonical without his authority, that he himself may be judged by no one, that the Roman Church has never erred, nor will it err to all eternity, the scripture bearing witness, that the Roman pontiff or pope, if he has been canonically ordained, is undoubtedly made a saint by the merits of Saint Peter, that the pope may depose and reinstate bishops without assembling a synod, that he who is not at peace with the Roman Church shall not be considered Catholic, and that he may absolve subjects from their obligations to wicked men. Now, obviously, it would be interesting to go through and talk about each one of those for an extended period. But you can just see the tremendous power that the popes claimed to themselves. And Gregory VII was one of those who made these extravagant claims. And again, the last of those that I showed you, that he may absolve subjects from their obligation to wicked men. In other words, the Pope had the power to tell all the subjects of a king or an emperor, you no longer have to obey or pay taxes to your kings. This, again, was the great power, not the only power, but perhaps the greatest power that the popes possessed. Well, that was Gregory II. Another pope to consider was Innocent III. In the same general era, although about 100 years after Pope Gregory VII, Pope Innocent III was the son, was the second of three popes significant in the struggle between the popes and the kings. Innocent III set the theme for his papacy with his theme verse, Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 10. He said, "See, I have set you this day over nations and over kingdoms to pluck up and to break down, to destroy and to overthrow, to build and to plant." You could say that more than any other pope before him or since his time, Innocent III controlled both the church and the state. So many of the things that Gregory VII proclaimed in his decrees, Innocent III actually fulfilled in the way that he ruled and reigned as pope. Pope Innocent III presided over the Fourth Lateran Council in the year 1215. In that Fourth Lateran Council, Innocent III commanded the following. First of all, he commanded the Crusades. He defined the seven sacraments, that is, the seven sacraments of the Roman Catholic Church. He defined and confirmed the doctrine of transubstantiation. He made confession to a priest and penance necessary for salvation. And he denounced the recently written Magna Carta of England, which gave the nobles some rights before the king. So again, you can see he exercised tremendous political power. And in this ongoing struggle between the popes and the kings, he was a pope who really established and sort of flexed his muscles, so to speak, against the kings of his time. Then a third pope that we're going to consider in this era. We talked about Gregory VII, Innocent III, now Boniface VIII, who is again almost 100 years after the time of Innocent III. So you have these three popes, each of them separated by about 100 years. But Boniface VIII was the third of these three popes, very important to the struggle between the popes and the kings. Boniface VIII was famous for his papal bull, Unum Sanctum. He issued that in the year 1303. A papal bull is simply an official document. They would affix a seal at the bottom of the document, giving it authenticity. And the seal in Latin was known as a bulla. So a papal bull was simply an official document. And in the important papal bull Unum Sanctum, which was a response to the struggles that Boniface VIII had with King Philip of France, he said this in Unum Sanctum, this papal declaration. He said, "There is one holy Catholic and apostolic church, outside of which there is neither salvation nor remission of sins." You have to admit, it's a very radical statement for someone to make. And here were some of the main points to this papal bull, Unum Sanctum. First of all, he declared that both the spiritual and temporal swords, so to speak, belong to the Pope as the vicar of God. You see, there was the idea that there was a spiritual authority pictured by a metaphorical sword, and there was the governmental authority by sometimes the literal sword of the kings. The Pope here in Unum Sanctum is claiming, again, this is Boniface VIII, he is claiming that both of those swords belong to the Pope because he is the representative of God. Secondly, the spiritual sword answers to God alone because the Pope is beyond judgment on earth. But, he said, the temporal sword, the sword exercised by the kings hold it in their hand, but it is under the authority of the Pope. It's under papal authority. And then, thirdly, he declared in Unum Sanctum that salvation is only possible when a person is submitted to the Pope. Now again, this was an obvious declaration of the Pope's authority, not only the kings and emperors, but over everyone, everything under his domain. And so these were radical calls for submission to the Pope. Now, the Pope issued this papal bull, Boniface VIII, to push back against Philip of France. So what did Philip of France do in response? Well, he questioned Boniface's legitimacy on the papal throne, and he ordered him to be arrested and put on trial. Boniface escaped, but he died in his effort to flee from Philip. Because he died running for his life, it was said that Boniface VIII ruled like a lion, but died like a dog. Now, the Pope following Boniface VIII was Clement V, and he tried to appease the kings he struggled with. He even moved the papacy to the French-ruled city of Avignon. You see, here the papacy was in exile to please the French King Philip. So no longer was the seat of the papal power in Rome, now it was in Avignon, France. This is known as the Babylonian captivity of the church, when the Pope ruled from Avignon from the year 1305 to the year 1377, so for 72 years. When the Pope finally returned to Rome, things got worse because the French king and rulers wanted him to stay in France. Now, this caused a great controversy that is known as the Great Schism, the division of the papacy. You see, when the Pope moves his headquarters to France to make a French king happy, then the kings who are not happy with the French are not going to be happy with the Pope. So there was a great division in the Roman Catholic world of Western Europe, and this great division is called the Great Schism, where opposing parties supported different popes. At one time, there were three different supposed legitimate bishops of Rome. The consular movement tried to solve the problem also. That's where they tried to call a council, church council, that would be greater than the popes and that could resolve this dilemma of the popes excommunicating one another. The Great Schism lasted 40 years, from 1378 to 1417, following the move of the papal headquarters from Rome to Avignon. Different political factions, backed by the kings of different nations, recognized first two, then three different popes at the same time. And as you might imagine, each one of these two or three popes, they all excommunicated the other. There was the so-called Roman faction. They supported Pope Urban VI. That was the German emperor, England, Hungary, Scandinavia. Then there was the Avignon faction. They supported Clement VII. This was France, Naples, Scotland, Spain, and Sicily. So it was a great big mess. A third line was suggested to eliminate the two competitors. So as I said before, at one time, there were three supposed popes over the Roman Catholic Church. Finally, the Council of Constance in the year 1414 ended the controversy by deposing all three of the claimed popes and by electing Martin V. The Council of Constance also tried to assert the authority of councils over the Pope, but it didn't really work. Those rulings were pretty much ignored by successive popes. The popes were still in charge of the Roman Catholic Church and had huge political influence, economic influence, and of course, spiritual influence to some degree or another over the church, over Western Europe. So in the 40 years of the Great Schism, where it wasn't really clear who the Pope was, the common people, the people who would go to the parish church all over Western Europe, they would know almost nothing of the controversy. After all, who would tell them? In their isolation, it could be that even their village priest did not know. And their archbishop would certainly know, but he wouldn't want to tell them of a controversy that might shake their very confidence in the church that claimed to be the only pathway to salvation. At the end of it all, the Great Schism made several things clearer than ever before. Number one, it made it clear the political nature of the office of the Pope. This was fundamentally a political office. Secondly, it showed the corruption of the political office, the papal office. Friends, we speak from time to time, and we have in the past, and maybe we will in another lecture, of the immorality associated with the papacy, and this is true. But apart from rank immorality, we also have just political corruption of the papal office. And this was made very plain by the Great Schism. But then it also showed the relative strength of the popes over councils for sure, and sometimes over kings. Now, in all of this, in my estimation, And again, you can take this for what it's worth, because this is sort of my analysis more than a telling of the historical story. In all of this, the church as an institution became more important to people than Jesus himself. In the minds of most people, and this was true for centuries throughout Western Europe and the Roman Catholic Church, in the minds of most people, salvation came through the church, not through Jesus. So what was important was keeping your connection to the church, not necessarily having a living connection by true trust and faith in Jesus Christ. You could say that the Roman Catholic Church developed a very neat theological package based on the idea that salvation was by the grace of God alone. That's what their theology said. But only the Church of the Pope, the Roman Catholic Church, only the Pope and the Church of the Pope could make God's grace available to mankind. And the church made this grace available through the sacraments. As mentioned before, Roman Catholic theology developed the idea of there being seven sacraments. Let's see if off the top of my head I can list these seven sacraments. Of course, you have baptism given to infants. You've got Holy Communion. You've got confirmation. You have marriage. You have holy orders, that is ordination. You have last rites. And I'm very embarrassed to say that somehow along the way, I'm forgetting one more of those things. But you had this package of seven sacraments. I guess I included both baptism, whatever the seven sacraments are. Grace is made available. Oh, confession of sins. How could I forget that? Confession is the seventh sacrament. It's not seventh in the list, but seventh that I remembered. It's through those sacraments that grace is made available to the people. So it's as if the only way that salvation can come, salvation comes by grace, but the only way you can get that grace is to receive it through the sacraments that the church provides. That makes grace available to you, and that brings to you salvation. Now, if grace can only be received through the church as an institution, that might make sense. But if the believer can come to Jesus and receive God's grace directly, then from my perspective, it makes no sense at all. Though I would say it's pleasing to the fleshly nature of man because it provides such a neat, certain, and achievable package. But that doesn't mean that it's according to the truth of God. Friends, the church, and I don't mean the church as is expressed by any one denomination or institution, but the church as it is before God's eyes, this wonderful body of his people throughout every generation, throughout every denomination, throughout every place in the world, going back all the way to the day of Pentecost, this great phenomenon of the church, it is a glorious thing, and all God's people truly do belong to the church. But the church is not the agent, is not the one who saves us. We come, each one of us as individuals, to Jesus Christ, who freely offers us his grace if we will receive it by faith. That is a relationship of trust and love in Jesus, where we trust in, rely on, and cling to him for our life, both now and in the age to come. Along the way, the church often forgot this, but we don't need to forget it. Well, I hope you can join us for our subsequent lectures. I've enjoyed this time with you today. We're going to continue on in the next lecture to consider what God was doing in the world during this period of the Christian Empire, the later period.